Okay, time for us to get started. We only have an hour, so I want to start promptly. First thing I would like to say is hello. I'm Ben Armstrong, and contrary to what this slide says, because I only just noticed this is not what's new in Hyper-V and Windows Server 2012. It's 2012 R2, but when they did the final edit, they put the guy's head over the top of the R2. If you have a really close look, you can actually see a little white pixel sticking out there from the R. So it's what's new in 2012 R2. Before I get started, though, I would like to do a couple of quick questions and polls of the room so I can know who you all are, where you're at, and make sure we cover information that you care about. So first question, I'd like to see a show of hands. Who here has Hyper-V deployed somewhere in their environment? That's good. That's what I want to see. I want to see most hands. Now for the really fun, awkward questions. So I'm going to ask, I want to see what people have as their primary hypervisor. And I do want to be really clear about this. So hopefully we all understand what I'm getting at when I say primary hypervisor, because most people these days actually have multiple virtualization platforms in their environment, which is fascinating in and of itself. But I'm sure many of you work in places where you have, let's say you have Hyper-V and VMware, and you have the Hyper-V guys, and you have the VMware guys. So I'm not asking what is your business's primary hypervisor. I'm asking what is your primary hypervisor. If you're the Hyper-V guy, then I want you to say that Hyper-V is your primary hypervisor. If you're the VMware guy in a business that has more Hyper-V, I'd like you to say that VMware is your primary hypervisor, because I want to know where your head knowledge is. So let's do show of hands. Who would say that Hyper-V is their primary hypervisor in their environment? Okay. Who would say VMware is their primary hypervisor? Okay. Who would say Xen? What? Who would say KVM? We got one hand there. Who would say KVM? Okay. Are there any options I've missed? Is there anyone who's like, I'm running something else? Okay. Good to know. So for the Hyper-V people, how many people are currently running 2012 R2? Okay. 2012? 2008 R2. Okay. Good to know. So for the VMware people, 5.5, 5.1, 5.0 or earlier. Okay. So I'm going to try and talk all of you through, what we've done in Hyper-V in this release, but also talk you through what I think is particularly interesting to you. I'm going to be completely upfront on two facts. First fact is I have far more slides than I can present in an hour, so I am going to be jumping over a couple. Apologize for that. I actually decided to put more slides in so that you guys have access to this afterwards. There's a bunch of slides at the end, which I think are going to be interesting to read. I may not get to them today. So please don't be too surprised if we get to 5 minutes before the end and it seems like I haven't got to the last slide yet, and I'm just like, and now we're going to open for questions. That's on purpose. The second thing is, as many of you probably saw, I just ducked out to get some coffee. I am quite badly jet-lagged. This is actually my third time zone transition in the last 4 weeks, and my body has no idea where it is right now, and it really wants to be going for a nap or going to sleep. So I'm going to try and keep things as lively as possible. But I do apologize if I yawn at some stage or if I have to stop to drink coffee. So I hope you'll be understanding on that. So before I get into the nitty-gritty of what's new in 2012 R2 and start talking about some of the reasons why we invested in the features that we invested in, I actually want to set a bit of a larger picture. I think this is really important, especially for the VMware people who are here. One of the most common questions I get is, Okay, and in fact, I got asked this question yesterday. I got asked, so price aside, why would you say that we should move to Hyper-V and to Microsoft's virtualization platform? And of course, I had fun answering that because my immediate response was, okay, now I'm assuming you're saying price aside because we're all acknowledged that Hyper-V is the cheaper option. So we don't have to have that debate. And if anyone wants to have an argument with me about Hyper-V not being the cheaper option, I would love to have that argument. Not going to do it here and now on stage, but it is the cheaper option. There are two reasons why I believe that Hyper-V is the right choice for people to be looking at. And the first one is actually our overall Cloud OS vision. Now, when we talk about Cloud OS and our cloud vision, one of the things that we talk a lot about is the concept of hybrid cloud. And I want to be really clear on what this means to us and what we as Microsoft see the future of cloud computing, of server computing. And this was actually a mentality and a process that we started on quite a while ago. So to give the full background and the full picture and history here, back in 2006, 2007, we at Microsoft realized, hey, we have to really get in the game on cloud computing. We're not treating this seriously enough. We have to get ahead of the curve, and we have to really invest. And we simultaneously started the efforts to work on Hyper-V and System Center for on-premises private cloud and on Azure for our public cloud offering. And one of the questions that we had for ourselves and one of the questions that our customers had for us is, hey, Microsoft, you're investing in private cloud, you're investing in public cloud. Like, what's the long-term strategy here? Like, surely, one of these is going to be the long-term winner. And as we actually spent a lot of time looking at this and thinking about it ourselves, and the realization that we came to is that actually we believe the long-term state is a hybrid state. We believe the long-term state is that people will have some workloads on-premises, some workloads at a regional host, or some workloads in a public cloud as it makes business sense. And that's the story that we're building towards. No, the reality is that today, when people are making a decision of, do I do this in private cloud or do I do it in public cloud? Am I doing it on-premises or am I doing it off-premises? Today, there are two factors that are being weighed. There's the business factor, what are the regulations I have to deal with? What are the compliance reasons? What are the so on? But there's also the technical factor. There are features and functions and capabilities that you'll get in private cloud today that you won't get in public cloud, and vice versa. And we want to make those differences go away. Oh, that's one of our big goals is that, and I'll be honest, we're not there yet. We're making progress. But our big goal is that one day, when you stand up a Microsoft private cloud, it's going to be running exactly the same bits as we're running in our data centers. You're going to have exactly the same experiences, capabilities, and functionality. Now, with us seeing that as kind of our North Star, I strongly believe that Microsoft is best positioned to execute on that plan. VMware is in a great position for private on-premises cloud. They are far behind us in public cloud. Amazon is in a great position for public cloud. Google is in a great position for public cloud. They are not in great positions for private clouds. Once you start looking at I'm going to be using both of these and I'm going to expect them to interoperate with each other, I think we are in a very good position to be driving forward on that. So a couple of things to highlight. I'm going to skip quickly over some slides. Oh, no, I'm missing slides. They didn't get my latest deck, so I'll just have to talk to it on this one. So, actually, that slide looked wrong, so I think they might have my wrong deck. I'm going to switch across to my laptop so that... Sorry about this. But that is going to throw me off if the slides are in the wrong order. Okay. So, one of the things that I'm really proud of as a Hyper-V guy is I talked about we're working towards having a story where what you run on-premises for private cloud is exactly what we run in our data centers. So while we were working, you know, between shipping 2012 and 2012 R2, we actually had a momentous event internally at Microsoft, and that was we got our Azure data centers moving across to standard, unmodified Windows Server running Hyper-V. So prior to that event, they had been running the Windows Server and Hyper-V codebase, but they'd been making changes and modifications and building their own version. And we've been working with them to be like, okay, here's our North Star. So we have to get onto standard bits. And today, you know, when you get an Azure virtual machine, it is running on standard Hyper-V just as you run it in your data centers. And this has like some fascinating implications. Oh, the first thing, and this one makes me smile, is when I'm talking to people who, you know, are using VMware, they're familiar with VMware, one of the common questions I get is, hey, you know, we have a lot of history with VMware. We know that it can run our enterprise apps. We know that it's got the stability and the reliability and the scale. Can you show me evidence that Hyper-V, you know, has, you know, similar capabilities? Well, we're running Azure. So let me break this down. You know, how many people here have tried out Office 365 or are deploying it in their environment? That's all running on Hyper-V. How many people here watched any of the events from the Sochi Winter Olympics? That was delivered by Hyper-V. How many people here have ever played a game of Titanfall? You were using Hyper-V, because all the server infrastructure on the back end for that is running in Hyper-V. I can assure you that on a daily basis, we are running workloads at scale and of importance that far exceed what VMware does. You know, just by the nature of, we're running all the Microsoft properties on the standard Hyper-V that you get today. So that's really exciting. So the next thing that I talk about is, you know, the reality is that for a period of time there, you know, when you looked at the virtualization space, you know, VMware was the innovator and we were catching up. You know, I freely admit to that. You know, when we had, you know, when it was, you know, Windows Server 2008 R2, I would go and I would talk with companies and they would say, hey, why should we use Hyper-V over VMware? And I would say, well, yeah, VMware's got some cool features that we don't have, but we're cheaper. Windows Server 2012 was a big release for us, and we had a lot of feedback from people that said, you know, for the most part, Windows Server 2012 is the release where you guys matched VMware in features and functionality, and we were still cheaper. And in 2012 R2, we put a lot of innovation in the platform, and there's now a long list of features and functionality and scenarios that I can point to with Hyper-V and say, either we did it first, or we're the only ones who did it. You know, I point to VMware vSphere 5.5. I love that release because it was VMware catching up to Hyper-V. Now, that's the simple fact of the matter. I mean, yeah, they did some great stuff, but the majority of what they did was them catching up to Hyper-V. And I'm super happy to be in the role where we're innovating, where we're pushing forward. So switching gears a bit, and what have we done? So there's a bunch of different things that went into 2012 R2. And I kind of categorize these in a couple of ways. The first group is the category that I put as moving virtualization forward. And this is the category of stuff where we sat down and said, okay, rather than improving something that we had, rather than looking at competition, what's something that we can do that's new, that hasn't been done before, that we can do in an interesting way because, you know, we're building Hyper-V as part of Windows. So the first feature to talk about here is a feature called automatic activation. And this came about from looking at the problem of how do you activate virtual machines in hosted environments. So let's do a show of hands. How many people here would say they operate as a hoster? Okay. How many people here would say they have some workloads that are running on someone else's, you know, infrastructure? They're using hosted services. Okay, so I would say just over half the room right here is either providing services or using services. And there are some great, you know, advantages to that model, but there are also a lot of problems. I was meeting with a hoster just yesterday, a local group. And one of the things that I talked to them about was I said, you know, we've on the Hyper-V team at Microsoft, we've spent a lot of time trying to figure out, like, hey, we've got this new emerging model where more and more people are moving towards using hosted services. You know, what do we have to change in order to be a good platform for that environment? And so we've spent a lot of time, you know, trying to understand this market, trying to understand the dynamics. Now, one of the statements that I make here, and it's something that I think's, you know, both amusing and incredibly valuable to understand, is if you're in a hoster tenant, you know, environment, you know, where you have one company or one, you know, organization in a company that's providing, you know, the functionality of, you know, a virtualization platform, and there's another group that's consuming it. If there is any situation where the end user has to talk to the guy who runs the hardware, we have failed because no one is happy. I don't care what the conversation is, even the simplest conversation. You know, people don't like that conversation. You know, the guys who run the hardware just want to run the hardware and run the virtualization platform. They don't want to have to know what's going on inside of the virtual machine. The people who use applications inside of those virtual machines don't want to have to be burdened by understanding the larger environment. And any time that these two parties have to work together on something, it's frustration on both sides. And so we've been looking at, hey, what can we do to take away those situations, to make it all just work magically? Automatic activation is a great example. You know, the way we license Windows for people who are hosters is we say, okay, you can license data center, and then instances of Windows under there are automatically licensed. But it becomes a real pain trying to figure out how to handle key management in that, you know, situation. So, you know, you stand up a new VM and you sell it to a customer and they install Windows. You know, whose key goes in there? How does it get activated? So on, so on, so on. So what we've done with automatic VM activation is we've built in functionality into a Windows server where it can detect that it's running inside of a virtual machine, check to see, is it running on top of a licensed and activated version of Windows Server Data Center? And if it is, you're then allowed to use, we basically have one standard key for this scenario. It's the automatic VM activation key. You drop it in there, and it's activated. And this works in any scenario. Now, this is great for dev test labs. This is great for trade shows like this. Because let me tell you, it was actually at TechEd New Zealand about 4 or 5 years ago now, 2 hours before I went on stage. I bought up the demo environment that I'd been using for a run of TechEd events, and all my VMs had tripped over their grace period for activation. I was in the speaker room sweating bullets because, you know, I had half a dozen VMs that I needed to activate, and, you know, internet wasn't working properly and so on. This is a very cool and useful feature, you know, and it makes it so much easier to activate virtual machines, especially in environments where the person who owns the virtual machine and the person who owns the virtualization platform are different people. The next thing we did was look at what we could do to modernize virtual machines themselves. And we came up with the concept of a Generation 2 virtual machine. So this is a very simple thing to use in Hyper-V. Basically, now when you create a virtual machine, you can choose a Generation 1 virtual machine or a Generation 2 virtual machine. And in a lot of ways, they look and feel the same, but there are a number of key differences. You can see here, you know, a Generation 1 virtual machine has more settings and options. Why is that? Well, it's because it actually needs them. So to kind of delve in deep for a moment and get a bit nerdy and technical. So when you create a Generation 1 virtual machine on Hyper-V, you are getting a virtual machine which is more or less compatible with the first virtual machine that we created in 1996 for virtual PC for Mac 1.0. And it's a virtual machine that we modeled off of 1996 technology in order to allow you to run Windows 3.1 on Mac OS really well. I kid you not. There is code that has come through all that time, but there's a lot of stuff in there where it's like, we have the Intel 440BX motherboard. We have, you know, PCI to ISA bus adapter in there somewhere because it's expected of the system. We have all the legacy cruft that you would expect of a 1996 Pentium 90. And it's interesting, you know, we've found some strange, you know, operating system bugs over the years where it's like, you know, funnily enough, the guys who wrote these operating systems never expected to see, Intel 440BX motherboard with 32 processors. We've found some interesting bugs. And we've really, you know, on one hand, that hardware platform has served us well. It's given us a lot of compatibility, and goodness knows, you know, we've got, you know, over a decade of lifetime out of it, but the world's moved on. So one of the really interesting industry trends that is happening is the emergence of UEFI devices. And this, I'm sorry, I'm going to get really technical and nerdy. This is what I like to do. So the old devices, and what probably most of the people in this room are used to, is you're used to the computers that you can boot up, hit Dell or F2, and go into the BIOS and fool around. Those are BIOS devices. And BIOS, as an architecture, was designed in the 80s. And it is a very rigid architecture that makes a lot of assumptions about computers. It assumes that a computer is always going to have a keyboard. It assumes that a computer is always going to have a serial port. It assumes that, you know, hardware is always going to be laid out in certain ways. Now, as the industry has been moving forward, and especially as we've been looking at devices like tablets and hybrid devices and the modern phone devices, the old BIOS architecture just doesn't work. We need something that's much more flexible where the boot environment can actually describe, hey, I've got some funky hardware, and it looks like this, in such a way that when the OS boots, it can discover that and understand it. And that's what UEFI is. It actually stands for Universal Extensible Firmware Interface. And it's a way for these platforms to describe themselves in a generic manner. And so for Hyper-V, a Generation 2 virtual machine is actually a UEFI-based virtual machine. And this has a lot of implications. So with a Generation 1 BIOS-based virtual machine, we had to have a bootable hard drive that looked like something you would find in the physical world. And so we had our IDE controller that you could boot off of and our SCSI controller that you couldn't, because our SCSI controller was fully virtualized. with a Generation 2 virtual machine, we're able to say, you know what? We don't need an IDE controller because we can describe in our firmware, we have this funky virtualized storage device that I can give you enough pointers that you can boot off of. Similarly, you know, we used to need to have legacy network adapters in order to boot. Now with Generation 2 virtual machines, we can describe what a virtual network adapter looks like to the operating system as it's booting up, so we no longer need that. And what that actually looks like when you're in the virtual machine is you can go and look at Device Manager, compare these side by side, you'll see a whole bunch of stuff in a Generation 1 virtual machine that frankly doesn't make sense to be in a virtual machine. You know, there's some great stuff here. You know, I love the floppy disk controller, the floppy disk. I love we have a processor to PCI bridge. It's a virtual processor. Like, the PCI bridge doesn't do anything. And if you go digging through there, you will actually, in a Generation 1 virtual machine, you will find a PCI to ISA bridge in there as well. It's there for compatibility to make sure that operating systems don't trip over. So, I can't use the clicker, I have to use keyboard. So I'm not going to drill in much on this. This is just a table. You can get the slides afterwards, and you'll see the comparison between the two. So what are the downsides of Generation 2 virtual machines? Well, here's where things get interesting, because one of the questions that I've got most often about Generation 1 versus Generation 2 virtual machines is, hey, when should I use one versus the other? It's kind of a tricky question to answer. So the first thing to be really clear about is, because it's a UEFI-based virtual machine, because we're taking advantage of all these new architectures, there is a much smaller set of operating systems you can run on. You can basically run the 64-bit versions of Windows 8 or later, the 64-bit versions of Windows Server 2012 or later, and we've only just got out versions. We're starting to see versions of Linux that support running in Generation 2 virtual machines. So the latest version of Ubuntu supports running inside of a Generation 2 virtual machine. I've been told there are other distributions that work. I don't have the definitive list on hand. But you know, the couple of the questions that I get here, the first one I get is, okay, so you've got this cool new Generation 2 virtual machine. When are you going to stop supporting Generation 1 virtual machines? And honestly, I don't know. People are really bad at forecasting the future. Reasonably, though, I would say we will most likely support Generation 1 virtual machines for as long as Microsoft supports an operating system that only runs in a Generation 1 virtual machine, which, to highlight, Windows 8.1 32-bit only runs in a Generation 1 virtual machine. So we've got at least 10 years of supporting Generation 1 virtual machines to go. You don't have to worry about moving across. But what about new virtual machines? Well, that's where things, let's say you're deploying a new virtual machine, it runs an operating system that supports Generation 2. When should you choose to use that? When should you not? This is a bit of a tricky one. So a couple of things to clarify. The first one is the benefits to using a Generation 2 virtual machine today are not that huge. I mean, it's cool, it's fun. There are some benefits. You can boot off of SCSI controller, so you only need one SCSI controller. You can boot off of virtual network adapters, so you don't need legacy network adapters. There isn't a huge performance improvement. Depending on whether I want to be honest or deceptive with figures, if I want to be deceptive with figures, I could say, well, if you are running a VDI deployment, Generation 2 virtual machines boot on average 15% faster than Generation 1 virtual machines. Sounds impressive. That 15% is about 2 seconds. Windows boots fast these days. So 2 seconds in boot time, not going to save you that much. An interesting thing, though really not that practical, is Windows installs incredibly fast in Generation 2 virtual machines compared to Generation 1 virtual machines. So if you want to geek out on this, it's a great thing to do. Create a Gen 1 and a Gen 2 virtual machine side by side and do a install race and see how they go out. But honestly, if you're installing operating systems frequently inside of virtual machines, you're doing it wrong. One of the great things about virtual machines is they're easy to clone, they're easy to copy. There are many easier ways to get, you know, a new virtual machine stood up and running than to sit down and install the operating system. So on many fronts, going with generation one virtual machines today is the safe thing to do. However, on the flip side, one, without disclosing details and information, yes, it is reasonable to assume that in the future there are going to be new features that we bring in and say, this is only for generation two virtual machines. There are things we want to do with the platform that you can only do on UEFI systems. But you know, generation one's not going away. The other thing to be aware of is, and when I was out here last year, people asked me this question, and I told them it was impossible. And then 2 months later, one of the guys on my team proved me wrong. So that's fantastic. I always like being proved wrong on things that I've said in public. So it is actually possible to convert a generation one virtual machine to a generation two virtual machine. This is not a simple process. As I've mentioned, generation one virtual machines are BIOS-based, generation two are UEFI-based. They're very different platforms and environments. One of the program managers on my team, John Howard, sat down and wrote a great script. It's very easy to use. You know, you plug it in and generation one virtual machine becomes generation two virtual machine. What it does behind the scenes is somewhat horrific. What it's actually doing, and it does this in a fully automated fashion, is it basically goes through the process of creating a backup image of your BIOS-based deployment and then deploying it to a new image that's structured correctly to boot on a UEFI system. And it does some fudging to create the UEFI partition structures and so on. It is, as I said, if you read through the script, it's pretty horrifying what it does, but it works reliably. And it's a supported process. So, you know, either way, you know, you're going to be able to get your virtual machines to where they need to be at the end of the day. I keep on using the clicker, and I haven't moved across. The next thing we did was the enhanced VM interaction with VM Connect. And this is actually a really fun thing. This is one of the things that excites me about doing virtualization at Microsoft, is when we get to do really cool, hard stuff, really easy, because we're Microsoft. So we got a lot of feedback from people using Hyper-V daily saying, hey, I want the experience when I go to use a virtual machine to be richer, to have more capabilities, to be more like a remote desktop session. And so we worked with the remote desktop team. And they actually enlightened remote desktop so that you can now, and this sounds like black magic, and it kind of is, you can now get a remote desktop session to a virtual machine even when the network's down. And you can get all the functionality that you would get from remote desktop. So I'm just going to quickly demonstrate what that looks like. If we bring up my Generation 2 virtual machine here. And let me highlight, I'm showing a Generation 2 virtual machine. The enhanced remote desktop does work with Generation 1 or Generation 2. It only works with Windows 8.1 or 2012 R2 guests. So this is, here I have the Hyper-V UI. I have the, you know, experience I normally have. However, it's not on the screen. And something's beeping. There we go. I don't know what the beeping is. That's someone's. Okay. Thank you for letting me know. So here I have my virtual machine. It looks and feels just like the virtual machine normally does. However, there's a bunch of things I can do now that I couldn't do before. I can copy and paste files between both environments. This is actually one of the things that we hear about most, is just being able to move simple data. I can also copy and paste text and graphical data. Let me bring this up. I'm trying to ignore the beeping. Did someone leave a phone? Is that someone left a phone? That's fantastic. If you're watching the live stream of this session and you know whose phone that is, go and slap them for me. Yeah, absolutely. Fantastic. Should put it up here. So I can copy and paste data in both directions. But, and I don't have time to demonstrate this, you actually get everything that you get with remote desktop. So you can do folder sharing so that you can get access to folders. You can do USB redirection. You get sound, you get video. You get everything that you get with remote desktop. However, a little highlight, I've set this virtual machine up with a disconnected network adapter. So all of this just works, makes it really easy. So let's put that away and jump back in. I am so going to run out of time. I'm looking at my little timer. There's no way I'm going to get through all of this. Time to go try and go really fast. So we also spent a lot of time looking at what we could do to make storage better. And here I'm going to jump through a couple of things. I apologize. We allow you to do online virtual hard disk resize. And this is, to be really clear, this is both expanding a virtual hard disk and shrinking. You know, a lot of people are surprised by the last one, but you can shrink a virtual hard disk. It works for Windows and Linux guests. The requirements are it has to be a VHDX guest, VHDX hard drive connected to a SCSI controller. So putting a little bit of math together, that also means if you want to do this for a boot disk, you have to be running a Generation 2 virtual machine. So this all just works. It's probably the guy ringing it trying to be like, where's my phone? So the next thing that we did was we started investing in building storage QoS into the platform. So I'm actually, because we're running short on time, I'm going to jump over my pretty slides, and I'm going to go straight to demoing this. So let's jump over. OK, I'll come back there. Let's demo this. So here's the scenario. You have a shared environment. Whether this is in your enterprise and you have different groups using the same virtualization fabric, or you're a hoster or you're using a hosted service. And one of the workloads, like this virtual machine, goes hot. And chances are, it's not malicious. No, this is just someone who's kicked off a batch processing job in their virtual machine. And the funny thing is, and I have heard this story many times, like user A kicks off batch processing job inside of a virtual machine. Now let me tell you, fascinating fact, like 95% of the time, someone kicks off a batch processing job on a SQL server or something, the very next thing they do is go out to lunch. This is a fact. That person now cannot be contacted for the next hour. 10 minutes later, the poor guy who's running the virtualization infrastructure and has no idea what's happening inside the virtual machine starts getting phone calls from other people complaining about bad performance. Well, this guy's happy. He's getting all the performance he wants. So the problem then becomes, what can you do to solve this? Now, the sad thing is, let me tell you, and I've heard this story so many times, what often happens is the way the person solves this is by turning this VM off. That's not a good solution, especially for the guy who gets to come back from his lunch break and find out that, you know, not only didn't his workload complete, his VM got turned off, potential data loss, so on. So what we've done is we've built in the ability to dynamically, at a fine-grained level, control I/O for a virtual machine. So I can come in here, and I can go to this virtual hard drive, and I can say, OK, let's cap this guy at 250 IOPS. And immediately, he's reined in. Now, the great thing is, the guy who went out to lunch, he doesn't care that it's going to take a little longer. He's out at lunch. No, he's going to come back. The work's going to be done. But the other people are happy, too. Now, that was actually the primary scenario that we designed this feature for. And it's what we call the noisy neighbor scenario. But having done this work, and I've been talking to people who've been using this feature and playing around with it, I've actually come across a second scenario that a lot of people are using this for. And this is more of a normative, predictable behavior. Because let me step you through a fascinating example of people do the craziest things when it comes to technology. I love this, because this is one of those stories which you don't see coming, but as soon as you see it spelt out, you're like, oh yeah, that's going to happen every time. So let's say you're in a medium to large enterprise, and you've decided that you're going to adopt VDI for your desktop strategy, and you're going to centralize a bunch and get rid of your thick clients and go with thin clients and yada, yada, yada. And you've decided, okay, I'm going to take 250 desktops, and I'm going to centralize them into a VDI farm. And you start crunching the numbers, and you're like, okay, 250 desktops, the average desktop hard drive operates somewhere in the 150 to 200 IOPS range. So 250 desktops, if you imagine they all went hot at the same time, would be 50,000 IOPS, but we're going to assume they're not going hot at the same time. We're going to scope our centralized storage for around 30,000 IOPS, and we're going to make sure we have, you know, a storage array that's capable of delivering that, and this all looks good. And you draw it out on paper, and you're like, yeah, this will work. This will be great. And so you get it up and running, and you do some trials, and life's good. But what happens, and this happens amazingly quickly, and let me highlight, these were users who had 175, 200 IOPS hard disks in their desktop environments. Is what happens is it doesn't take very long for your users to notice, hey, sometimes this is really fast, and sometimes it's not. No, they notice that, like, if I'm using my desktop late at night, when no one else is around, like, wow, my jobs and my operations have fly through. But if I try and do something at 9:30 in the morning, and what they don't connect is that the 9:30 in the morning performance is about the same as what they were getting on their desktop before. Because all of a sudden they're not comparing it to what they used to have, they're comparing it to like what they can get at 6 p.m. at night. And it doesn't take long at all before those people are being grumpy at you, saying, hey, we don't have enough infrastructure in place. Like, the performance is terrible in the morning. And I've seen this happen time and time again. And it's fascinating that there are environments where consistent performance is more important than peaky performance. And so what you can do for that sort of environment is, stand up your VDI farm and by default cap people at 200 IOPS. It ensures that they get consistent performance and they don't observe, these peaks and troughs, throughout the day compared to other people's workloads. So that's actually something that I've been seeing more and more people doing. So let's get rid of that. And now this is the fun part, because if I'm foolish, I forget to close this and I wonder why the rest of my demo is performing badly. I have done that before. So, next area we invested in was guest clustering. And here we added the ability to do production-grade guest clustering with shared VHDX. So this is not using Fiber Channel or iSCSI. Is just using a VHDX. This is great because you don't have to create specialized storage for guest clusters. You can just use VHDX files like other environments. It makes it a lot easier to spin these up. It makes it a lot lower cost. It makes the management a lot simpler. And the way that we make it sure that this is a production grade thing not just a development and test is. We only support this if the VHDX file itself is residing either on a cluster shared volume or a highly available SMB share. And we actually use the file sharing semantics that comes from that platform to arbitrate access. So I'm going to skip over that. Here's when I should have done my storage demo. Another thing we did was supporting deduplication for running virtual machines in VDI workloads. Now, one of the first questions everyone asked me is like, well, that's weird. Why do you say for VDI workloads only? The short answer is because that's the only workload we got around to testing before we shipped. So technically, don't know of any reason why it wouldn't work for other workloads. We haven't come out and said that's supported yet, simply because we haven't done the due diligence on testing that. We did do a lot of work to test VDI deployments and make sure that all the scenarios work with the performance we want. The final thing to say on storage is the performance fact. And this is really fun. This has been the ongoing, and I shouldn't say this on stage because I'm being recorded, but I'm going to anyway because I'm jet lagged and I'll plead defense on this. This is the ongoing pissing match between Microsoft and VMware. And we actually, we continue to invest here. So Hyper-V 2012 R2, 1.6 million IOPS from a single virtual machine. And you may say like, okay, that's just crazy. Like, why are you guys investing in that? And I have a couple of answers. The first answer is, don't you understand the meaning of a pissing match? The second answer is, actually, where storage is going, 1.6 million IOPS isn't as crazy as it used to be. We actually achieved this not on a crazy over-the-top rig. The storage rig that we use for this has, I believe it has 48 commercial SSDs connect. No, it's 64 commercial SSDs connected to 8 LSI controllers on a single box. And it's all white box stuff that we pretty much order from local suppliers and throw together. It's not a very expensive rig that puts through this sort of amazing throughput. The final thing to understand is whenever we work on this, what we're essentially doing is we're increasing the efficiency of storage and reducing our overhead. So even if you aren't getting near these sorts of crazy throughput numbers, you see the benefit from us continuing to refine the platform. So, moving on. So I've talked about what we've done for moving virtualization forward. I've talked about what we've done for storage investments. There's also a bunch of work that we've done for improving private cloud deployments. So the first thing that we did is we added support for zero downtime upgrade through cross-version live migration. So if you have 2012 workloads, you can live migrate them to 2012 R2 with zero downtime. Now, one thing that I would really like to highlight here, and this is where I'm going to not say anything that I'm not allowed to say. Okay, so I have to step very carefully. One thing I do want to be really clear about for people who are in the audience, who are managing Hyper-V deployments, is a lot of the old school server mentality is, I'll upgrade every other server release, or maybe I'll wait for a third server release. And, I'll wait until there's enough features and enough functionality and so on. Well, I would caution that. And I would caution that with two statements that I'm going to very carefully make. The first statement, which I can make comfortably, is we're very interested in making it easy for you to painlessly upgrade, your virtualization platform to future versions so that you can get new functionality in your virtualization platform. We think that's great for everyone. Great for you, great for us. The one that I'm going to say very carefully and choose my words on is doing stuff like cross-version live migration is hard, to say the least. You can imagine that as a general rule of thumb, we might only support this from one version to the next version. And so it would be wise to think about, okay, how do I stay on, you know, the leading edge? You know, it is highly unlikely that we'll be going like, oh yeah, you can do cross-version live migration from, you know, the version of Hyper-V 5 years ago to the version that we, you know, release tomorrow. It is more likely that we will be thinking about like, okay, like stay on the latest version and we can make things better for you. So that's something I would really encourage people to be thinking about, you know, as they're looking at deployments and looking at features. The next thing we worked on was faster live migration. And this is, we've done two forms here. We've done faster live migration with compression and faster live migration with SMB Direct. And I am so going to run close on time. So faster live migration with compression. This is simple enough. You know, a couple of things to bring in here. The first thing is most virtualization servers today, actually even post-consolidation, still woefully underutilize their processors. When we go out and talk to customers and survey data centers and so on, what we actually find is that the average workload spot for a virtualization server is about 30% CPU utilization. They're resource constrained in other ways, storage IOPS being one of the leading ones today, but there's CPU sitting around. So what we did was we built an algorithm where when you do a live migration, we will opportunistically compress the memory and reduce the amount of data that we have to send. Now we're very careful that we don't use too much CPU. We constantly monitor, you know, how much CPU is available, and we only use what's available. If virtual machines need that CPU, we will throttle our compression algorithm. But compression is a great feature. It's turned on by default. So you deploy 2012 R2 and bam, you know, live migration is faster. In our testing for the average workload, this is 2 to 3 times faster. My favorite story around live migration with compression is we actually, when we first developed this technology, we turned it on by default in the build, and we then actually had to turn it off for a week because it broke a number of our tests because live migration was now too quick. In particular, we had one test that we run on daily build that goes through and tests to make sure that you can safely and reliably cancel a live migration. And this test would basically kick off a lot of live migrations and then go through and try and cancel them all. And when we turned on compression, it started failing because it couldn't cancel them all in time. You know, it would kick off live migrations and then it would start canceling them, and before it got through the queue, a number of them had finished. So it would try and cancel them and it'd be like, nope, can't do that. So that's fantastic. So the next thing we did was live migration over RDMA. So actually, here's a moment for another show of hands. How many people here have actually tried out RDMA-enabled networking hardware? Kind of what I was expecting. I would really encourage you guys to be looking at this. It is coming down in price. It is getting easier and easier to get. I actually, just 2 months ago, I spec'd out what it would take to get the cards and networking gear to set up a test lab just with two boxes within RDMA interconnect. It was about $900. The performance of this is staggering, absolutely staggering. What? Yeah. Yeah, it's difficult to find in America, let me tell you. It is worth doing the investigation because the performance is staggering. We've seen performance increases of live migration of 10x. We actually built a test box where one of the things, we built this over SMB Direct, which actually means we also get multi-channel. So we built a test box where we just went, you know what? We're going to just keep on throwing RDMA-enabled adapters in here and see how fast we can get this to go. You know, we'd started off with a single connection, got a certain speed, threw in another pair, got faster, threw in another pair, got faster. when we threw in the fourth pair, we saw no performance improvement. So we went in and we analyzed the system to try and figure out, okay, where are we bottlenecking? And what we realized was that with two systems, it was three dual connection RDMA adapters between them, we were actually transferring memory at the speed of the memory bus between these two systems. We were moving data for a live migration at 16 gigabyte a second. Insane performance. So I'm running short on time, so I'm going to skip over this demo. But I'm going to say, why is this important? Well, it's important because there are operational activities like rolling out a patch in a cluster, which cause you to have to live migrate every virtual machine. And most people will babysit this process. I know some people trust us enough that they'll just kick it off and go to sleep. And God bless them for that. Glad that there are people out there. But most of us babysit this process. We push out an upgrade and we watch the system. And that is really boring. Just is. It's not a fun day. So the sort of figures that we're talking about, 8-node cluster, 128 gig each. We're talking about going from 8 hours to patch everything down to 4 with compression down to an hour. Well, actually, 47 minutes is what we calculated. Let me tell you, this is an area that we're going to continue investing in, is how can we make these large-scale operational activities faster and easier to do. So some simple guidance that people ask me, when should I use compression, when should I use SMB? Here's the little rule we came up with. Look at how much bandwidth you have available for live migration. If it's 10 gigabit or less, use compression. If it's over 10 gigabit, use SMB/SMB direct. Now, you might have a lot of questions about, what if I have only one link? What if I have multiple links? What if I do have RDMA? What if I don't have RDMA? Yada, yada, yada. Let me tell you, we've tested all of them. This guidance holds. It isn't a discussion of how many links or what the capability is. It's just what the bandwidth is. So I am going to skip a bunch of stuff. I said I had too much stuff. So another thing that we invested a lot in was Linux support. And this is actually something that we invested a lot in 2012 R2. But because, I don't know if you guys have noticed this, Linux ships separately than Windows. Little pro tip there. We frequently release new functionality for Linux running on top of Windows. So with the 2012 R2 release, we had full dynamic memory support, both add and remove, just like we do on Windows Server with pressure reporting and everything. We added support for online backup, so we can do a file system consistent backup of Linux using the VSS infrastructure in the host environment. So you can get enterprise backup solutions working perfectly with Linux. Online VHDX resize, a new video driver. And since we released 2012 R2, we've also released full support for KVP in Linux. We've added support for time synchronization in Linux. We have added support for IP address configuration through Replica. We're going to continue investing in this. And all of this functionality we're putting straight into the Linux mainline. So, skipping my demo again, apologies. Hyper-V replica. So we did a couple of key investments here. The first big one was we allowed you to configure the replication interval. With 2012, it was fixed to 5 minutes. With 2012 R2, we allow you to do 30 seconds, 5 minutes, 15 minutes. First question I always get is, but I want more options. Yeah, I understand. And people ask me, why didn't you make this a slider? And why didn't you make it infinite options? And my answer is, people, we had 12 months to do 2012 R2. We looked at the scenarios that people wanted. We chose some things that we could test and get really confident in. And that's where we came up with these presets. And we believe they'll cover most scenarios. The next thing that we did was we added support for extended replication. This is a big one. You know, this is allows you to replicate from server A to server B, and then to replicate again from server B to server C. The most common deployment that we see for this is, I'm a medium to large size business. I want to use Replica to protect my workload, but I have a dilemma. Do I do it on premises, or do I do it to a regional hoster? And the answer is, you really want to do both. And so this lets you do that. You do your first hop on premises, and your second hop to a regional hoster. And as I'm out of time, I'm going to make Alessandro uncomfortable and say, if you want to know more about Replica, you should go to his session. It's tomorrow at 11:55. What room? You don't know what room? What's the title? What's the title?
315.
So 315, Automating Disaster Recovery with Azure Site Recovery. So I would highly recommend that you go there. Which is great, because that allows me to skip over the slides I have on Azure Site Recovery. See, I've got all these ones on Azure Site Recovery, and I'm out of time. So we can see, if you want to know more about this diagram, go to Alessandro's session. So with that, I would like to stop. I do, as I mentioned, I do have a bunch of slides in here for you to look at. They talk about our free Microsoft Hyper-V server and explain that it has all the functionality of Windows Server Data Center running Hyper-V, only it's free. That's kind of what free means. There's also a bunch of slides that talk through what we believe you should be looking at if you're planning a private cloud deployment on Hyper-V. With that, I would like to wrap up. I would like to thank you all. And I am a minute over time, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to head downstairs to the hub, and if you have any questions, please feel free to follow me down there.